is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If we do not do things differently this festive season, we will greet the new year not with joy, but with sorrow. Unless we do things differently, this will be the last Christmas for many, many South Africans.
That's South African President Cyril Ramaphosa urging citizens to follow new restrictions to curb the coronavirus. Details coming up. Also, the head of the ECOWAS poll observers in Ghana says last week's elections were transparent and credible. And Boko Haram militants have claimed responsibility for the abduction of 300 students in Nigeria's northern Katsina state. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. There's been widespread condemnation of separatists in Cameroon for a string of attacks and abductions of traditional village chiefs. Anglophone rebels released two chiefs on Monday but killed another for defying their demand not to participate in Cameroon's December 6th regional elections. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Scores of the Banda villagers near southwestern Cameroon's Boya town are mourning their chief, whose body was found Sunday after he was abducted by rebels. Cameroon authorities say Chief Emmanuel Ngale Ikome was abducted on December 13 with two other village chiefs. They were freed on Monday unharmed. His daughter, 37-year-old Libonge Eposi, says the Anglophone separatists also abducted four family members when they attacked the palace.
Chief E and his two friends,
she says a few dozen people who were in the palace escaped to neighboring houses and bushes when the rebels were shooting indiscriminately in the air. Eposi says Chief Ikomi was abducted along with two other village chiefs who had come for the inauguration of the newly constructed Dibanda Palace building. Cameroon's government says rebels abducted four other village chiefs in the northwest region last week. Two were immediately released, but the whereabouts of the other two is unknown. Boya lawmaker Donald Malomba Esembe, who visited the bereaved family on Monday, says the rebels killed Chief Ikomi because he took part in Cameroon's first regional elections on December 6. He called for villagers to arm themselves against the rebels.
It is very preoccupying that the chiefs are being specifically targeted. I am calling on the people of Boya, people of goodwill. Each of us has to become a vigilante in our villages and communities.
Cameroon's rights groups and political parties condemned the attacks on village chiefs as a desecration of the African traditions. The separatists accused the chiefs of collaborating against them with the central government in Yaoundé. Boya administrative official Abba Abdurrahman also visited the palace of the slain chief. He says the military will collaborate with militias to stop separatists from attacking village chiefs.
We have come to condole with the bereaved family, but to a larger extent to condole with the entire community. We have also come here to assure the bereaved family of the infringing resolve of the state of Cameroon to stand by them, fight those who are against peace.
Cameroon authorities in 2018 said a majority of village chiefs in the troubled western regions were fleeing the area to escape rebel attacks. Cameroon's government in September pleaded with the chiefs to return to their palaces to take part in the December regional elections. Cameroon organized the elections in part to help resolve the four-year separatist conflict, which the United Nations says has claimed more than 3,000 lives and displaced over 430,000. But separatist leaders in social media threatened to kill anyone who supported the polls. The separatists are fighting for an independent state for English-speaking Cameroonians, who they say have been marginalized by the country's French-speaking majority. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Nigeria's Boko Haram militants have claimed responsibility for the abduction of hundreds of students in an attack on a boys' school in northern Katsina State. More than 300 students remain missing from the government's science secondary school after gunmen attacked Friday night. Many of the more than 600 students at the school were able to escape during the attack. An online newspaper, the Daily Nigerian, said it received an audio message from Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekau, saying his group abducted the school boys. So far, there has been no independent verification of the message. Nigerian President's spokesman, Garaba Shehu, said yesterday that the kidnappers had made contact and discussions are going on regarding the safety of the children and their return home. He did not identify the kidnappers, but several armed groups operate in northern western Nigeria, where Katsina State is located. Boko Haram, which began operating in northeastern Nigeria more than a decade ago, is among the largest militant groups operating in the country. It is responsible for thousands of deaths and kidnappings. In South Africa, an internal process of the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, has recommended that the party's second highest official vacate his post pending the outcome of a criminal case against him. ANC Secretary General Ace Magashule is facing 21 charges, including corruption and fraud related to a multi-million dollar tender. Darren Taylor has more.
The decision by the ANC's Integrity Commission reinforces President Cyril Ramaphosa's commitment to suspend party members charged with serious crimes. Magashule denies all the allegations against him. In a recent interview with local news channel ENCA, he branded the charges as a political conspiracy against him and his allies. Magashule told ENCA he'll meet anyone with evidence against him in court early next year. Senior ANC official Jesse Duarte says even though the party's Integrity Commission says Magashule must leave office for now, certain processes designed to deal with allegedly criminal members still need to be followed.
They can voluntarily step aside, not step down. Stepping down means you completely leave and you never come back. Stepping aside means you may vacate your position until the matter that is before you has been cleared or resolved. Or you could go to an internal disciplinary committee of the ANC for further questioning.
But ANC veteran Ike Morwe asks, in Magashule's case, what would be the point of this?
If he's going to appear to explain, you know, his case, that is not the right place because that would be sub judice. He must go and explain himself before the courts.
In 2009, Morwe served a very short time as one of Magashule's advisers when the ANC Secretary General was Premier of the Free State Province.
I know him pretty well, but, you know, looking back, I think, you know, he was a caricature of a tin pot dictator. One would think that he's joking with things that he used to say and do.
Morwe says Magashule is drawing his support from one specific section of the ANC.
You look at the people that he was with outside the Bloemfontein court, all of them, you know, have got, in one way or the other, issues that they must answer, you know, to. He is basically being protected by people on the wrong side, you know, of ANC principle, disciplines, constitution, and the laws of the country.
Magashule points to local ANC branches around the country that are backing him as proof of his popularity. But Morwe says this is misguided.
The majority of people who support him in branches are people who don't know the ANC from a bar of soap, who cannot even quote you, you know, one simple principle of the ANC. Those are the people who who joined the ANC for his sake, because apparently they are getting something out of being members of the ANC, you know, through supporting him.
Magashule maintains the ANC needs him, and that without him, it just won't be the same. Morwe responds that for once, he hopes that Magashule is right. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa has tightened COVID-19 regulations after the announcement that the country was experiencing a rapidly expanding second wave of COVID-19 infections. A curfew, alcohol sales restrictions, closure of some beaches, a ban on large gatherings are some of the restrictions citizens will contend with throughout the festive season. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said the measures were unavoidable given the fast pace of the second wave.
If we do not do things differently this festive season, we will greet the new year not with joy, but with sorrow. Unless we do things differently, this will be the last Christmas for many, many South Africans.
Under the new rules, Ramaphosa announced Monday night, gatherings are restricted to 100 people indoors and 250 outdoors. All beaches and public parks in the Eastern Cape province, which has the country's second wave hotspots, have been closed. Beaches and parks in Durban and other areas in KwaZulu-Natal have been ordered to close on all peak days, including Christmas Day. A curfew has been imposed across the country from 11 p.m. to 4 a.m., and it includes Christmas Day and New Year's Eve. The sale of alcohol now is limited to between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. from Monday to Thursday. Premises and public transportation that do not require customers to wear masks or don't follow sanitizing protocols and social distancing faces severe consequences.
The responsible individuals who do not ensure compliance with the regulations by their passengers, customers, or employees will be liable to a fine or to imprisonment of up to 6 months.
The announcement has wilted the Christmas spirit, says Johannesburg resident Denzel Mokwena.
I think it's going to be a bit weird, like not normal, you know. We're not used to such a situation. Even events, we can't have events. So we just have to do our best, you know, to make it a better Christmas, eh? Even though it's a sad one. But yeah, it's up to each one of us to make it a better Christmas.
The restrictions would be a big blow to the tourism industry, which usually is very busy during the festive season. Some industry players say they will stay positive, thanking the government for not completely shutting down the sector. Johannesburg-based political analyst Zenzo Moyo says this was a difficult decision for the government, considering the state of the economy, but it had to be done.
A message needs to be sent to the citizens of South Africa and those that are coming into South Africa and those that are going out of South Africa, that we have a likelihood of experiencing an even worse wave than what has been experienced before.
Daily new coronavirus infections in South Africa are now bordering around 8,000, compared with below 2,000 a day in November. So far, more than 800,000 people have been infected, with at least 23,000 deaths. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The head of the ECOWAS poll observer mission says Ghana's recent elections were transparent and credible. Madame Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says, despite reports of isolated cases of violence, the voters had no problem casting their votes. Her remarks come after the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, attorney Jean Adukewe Mensa, declared incumbent president Nana Akufo-Addo winner of the presidential election with 51.59% of the total votes cast. His main challenger, former President John Dramani Mahama, came in second with 47.36%. To learn more about the assessment of the ECOWAS poll observer mission monitoring the Ghanaian elections, VOA's Peter Clotie caught up with Madame Johnson Sirleaf, former Liberian president and head of the Election Observer Group.
Madam President, talk to us about your overview of the Ghanaian election.
Ghana elections, I think, are exemplary. Exemplary because it was peaceful, because the entire process was transparent. Everyone could observe, including the average citizen who could stand at any of the polling places and watch the process, watch the vote, watch the counting of the votes. The fact that the party agents were very in close proximity with the process, they could see, you know, when the voter register was validated by the biometric device. They could see that process to make sure that the device worked. They could see when the vote was taken. Security agents were there. But they were very quiet, reserved. All they did was observe to make sure there was no infraction of the peace. The officers, you know, the election officers, were professional. How they handle it. So what can I say about that? Yes, there were one or two incidents that we had reported in places where force, and unfortunate in one case is a shooting incident that involved in deaths. I think those sort of just put a small dot on Ghana's tradition of peaceful election with no incidents. And that again is a reflection of the fact that our societies have population that are larger, that are younger, you know, that are more demanding, and sometimes when aggravated, you know, can react in a manner that's contrary to the usual. So I say we can give Ghana's election very high marks. I don't want to get into numbers.
Right.
I think that number will come from Kudeo,
the domestic poll observers.
Yes, and they will handle that.
Madam President, I was at the Electoral Commission so-called strong room when you came to be briefed about the electoral process, how they would get the results from the other regions. And I saw you nodding your head. Were you comfortable with the entire process in terms of how the Electoral Commission administered the poll?
Yes, I was, because everything I've said about the process of the polls followed what had been arranged by the Elections Commission. And everywhere there were issues. There were issues, for example, about the voter rolls. And I think they were addressed, and the numbers that now come out show that all those roles did was to add those who had now qualified, the younger people that now qualified, having reached the voting age. There were issues about masks, and I think that was easily addressed by them by ensuring that masks were sent to places for voters who did not have a mask. And so I think the Election Commission, under the circumstances with the huge population increase, with the fact that they regionalize things and the fact that Ghana's territory is so large, the number of polls are so many to cover, I think you've got to say to them that they did a job well done. It was well done.
That was VOA's Peter Clotie speaking with Madame Johnson Sirleaf, former Liberian president. A new report from the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says the well-being of children in sub-Saharan Africa is under siege from all directions since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The region is now suffering an economic recession, and UNICEF says that it has pushed about 50 million more people into extreme poverty. The majority of them are children. Mavis Ochera in Juwaso, in the Ashanti region of Ghana, has more.
UNICEF says there now are likely more than 500 million people living in extreme poverty in sub-Saharan Africa. That is nearly double the number in 1990 when progress against the Millennium Development Goals started to be measured. The region's 550 million children already face many challenges, but the pandemic has intensified those problems and created new ones. Matthew Kamis is the UNICEF Social Policy Regional Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa based in Nairobi. He says UNICEF's latest report show that COVID-19 has been a catastrophe for children in Africa and recommends a massive international plan to turn things around, including the use of cash transfers to families. He says 4 out of 5 children in the region suffer from what's called multidimensional poverty. They are unable to access basic social amenities like clean water, health facilities, and a decent place of accommodation. Around 35 million children were out of school, although governments have tried to expand remote learning, and 280 million face food insecurity.
Since then, children have been battered by a long list of new challenges. We've just, for example, gone through the most severe economic shock in history, which has led to the biggest increase in extreme poverty in sub-Saharan Africa ever recorded. Beyond that, we can look at all of the other COVID-19 related side effects. That's rising prices of basic things like food, water, transportation, medical supplies, and
Kamis say the region had expected 1.6% economic growth this year before the pandemic. Now, there are predictions sub-Saharan nations will see their economics contract by 1.6%. In some countries, such as Nigeria and South Africa, the International Monetary Fund expects growth to fall by 5% or more. He says looking at some of the extreme cases in Burundi and the Republic of Congo, their average per capita income in 2020 is lower than at any point in the past 40 years. The pandemic comes on top of droughts, floods, locusts, invasions, and conflicts.
Intensifying conflicts, we can look to Mozambique, Ethiopia, South Sudan, many parts of the Sahel right now. The big takeaway is that this generation of young persons was in a very bad place before 2020, and they have been undergoing a series of very intense blows, which has led to, you know, really staggering losses of human capital, education, and nutrition. And we know that all of this will also impact not just children's, but this is also a huge impact on economic development and overall potential of the region.
Kamis say giving cash to households could mitigate most of the challenges facing children, and it will boost economic growth, build social protection systems, and future resilience to shocks. He said it would achieve big cost saving over time. He says UNICEF and some governments in the region have worked together to test cash transfer programs and have documented the benefits. He says many governments put cash transfers at the center of their crisis response this year. But in sub-Saharan Africa, expanded programs reach only 15% of the population, leaving millions without help to reach them. Governments need donor aid.
We also advocate for a minimum of 6 months of emergency cash support, but ideally it would be 12 months or longer, recognizing that the longer these programs are sustained, the bigger the benefits. In terms of the cost, if we were to operationalize this program across all of sub-Saharan Africa, we're talking somewhere around $50 billion. That's about the same amount of foreign aid that was flowing into sub-Saharan Africa before the crisis.
Can we say cash transfer programs could increase per capita economic growth by around 5% on average, which could push most countries in the region back on a positive track? Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Barrow, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.